Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc. All rights reserved.
Welcome back. It's Joe Cocker, that crazy Englishman. Still rocking. High time she went. Welcome back. It's 23 after the hour. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate. Thank you very much for hanging around with me. It's just you and me. We're going to talk about, I'm going to cover some of the things that Kiplinger has to say about what's going on in the world these days. The lead story today is on commodities. And Kiplinger says there's going to be, that we got another bubble brewing here. You know, we just had a, some people call it a housing bubble. And I guess you could kind of say it was a, I'm loath to say it was a housing bubble because I denied that there was a housing bubble for all those years. And I still kind of believe that. But the housing bubble was really not so much a housing bubble as it was a mortgage bubble, a collateral bubble. That's what it was. See, it wasn't so much that the housing prices were a bubble. It's that the collateral and the securitizing of that collateral became a bubble. And that's different. That's a different topic altogether. And even though it's still about real estate. Well, so we had this real estate issue that included what I'm going to call a collateral bubble, not a real estate bubble. And we had that, and that's basically popped, and it's continuing to deflate. But now we've got another bubble, and it's Kiplinger calls it a commodities bubble. And they say that it's unsustainably high. And if you think about it, that's what's, you know, it is pretty high. There are, you know, corn is going through the roof. You got, I don't have to tell you about oil prices, over $100 a barrel. You got gold above 900 now? Maybe didn't it get to 1,000 at one point in time? You know, gold hung out around 300 or so bucks an ounce for decades almost. And it hardly ever moved up or down. And then all of a sudden now it's run up to a really high rate. A lot of people, you know, when they see gold above $900, that just really convinces them that we got major inflation. And, of course, that's where a lot of the inflationary indicators come from commodities. And a lot of the foodstuffs, as I said earlier, corn and the grains, those are all going higher. So why are the commodities so high? Now, I'm not a commodities expert, but here's what I think. A lot of people have pulled their money out of equities, out of the stock market. Maybe even out of bonds. I don't know. I don't know how attractive corporate bonds are these days. But that money needed to go somewhere. And we have had this increased interest in commodities for a lot of different reasons, because of global demand, right? We got all these third world countries, India, China coming on, their economy's growing like crazy. All this extra demand, all these countries around the world are getting a piece of the capitalist action, and they're becoming more entrepreneurial. And when that happens, people consume, they make things, and civilizations, societies, cultures grow and improve, and people get jobs and they buy stuff, and that requires raw materials, which is part of the commodities. And so the price that started going up, and so I think a lot of investors kind of got on the commodities bandwagon, and that's driven some of the prices up, plus just the concern over the overall economy. I mean, a lot of people, if you know, when they get, a lot of smart investors, of which I'm not one, by the way, when they get concerned about the global economy, they go to gold, they go to the metals, because they feel that the metals are, you know, have this intrinsic value that's not gonna be affected as much as, say, the dollar will or a share in General Motors or something like that. And so they move their money towards those commodities. Now, there are other reasons why the commodities are high, though, and this is maybe an argument. Well, let me back up and say this: speculation on commodities is also driving not just money coming into commodities, but speculation on those commodities is what's driving the price up. And you've heard experts on this show before say that they believe that maybe as much as 25% of the price of crude oil right now is due to the cost, is due to speculation. It's speculators driving the price up. And part of the reason for that is because of the unrest in the Middle East. And if you notice, every time there's a little tete-a-tete over in the Middle East, Iran rattles a saber, there's a setback in Iraq, or something happens over there, the price of oil goes up. That's what happens, right? But another reason why oil prices have been high is because of demand. Part of the increase is demand because of the additional oil that China and India, for example, are using and are going to continue to be using. So we've got all of those things that are driving the price of commodities up. Oh, one more thing. The increased interest in alternative fuels, meaning ethanol, at this moment I'm talking about ethanol, which is corn-based basically, has also driven up the price of oil. I'm sorry, of commodities, specifically corn. And because that's driven the price of corn up, so much of the foods that we eat, especially that come from manufacturers, have some kind of corn in it, some kind of corn oil or sugar from corn or whatever, some commodities, some grains. That's driving the price of food up. So all these are commodities, and they're all going up. Kiplinger says it's going to be a bubble to burst. And when we come back, I'm going to talk about that. 29 after. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Yep, he's done it again, folks.
Oh, no, not again. Oh, my. Oh, my. Oh, my goodness gracious.
Named to Talkers Magazine's Heavy 100 for the third year in a row.
It's not the first time. It won't be the last.
He's Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate.
Welcome back. It's 34 after the hour. Thank you very much for hanging around with me today. It's Jim Blassingame. Glad to be with you. And it's just you and me, and I'm talking about some of the issues that Kiplinger proposes in their most recent Kiplinger letter. And we're talking about commodities for the time being. And if you remember in the previous segments, I talked about the case for the bubble. How the commodities bubble got started and what's driving the commodities bubble. Part of it is demand, part of it is speculation, part of it is energy issues, like I mentioned ethanol. And so Kiplinger, though, says that the bubble is going to burst, and probably by midsummer. Now, what could cause the bubble to come down? Let's talk about how that could happen. One thing that could happen that could cause the bubble to burst is equities, stocks, starting to become more attractive to investors. And when investors see that there's an opportunity to move their money out of chasing commodities and pushing the price up and speculating on commodities, when these large traders especially see that opportunity, they're agnostic. Most of these people are agnostic with regard to whether they're investing in a stock or a bond or a warrant or a commodity or a bean or a barrel of oil. Most of them are a pork belly. Most of those guys don't care one way or the other. They just want to see where the movement is, and they want to be in front of that movement. And so if equities start picking up, which a lot of people believe that it will in the second half of the hour of the year, then they're going to get tired of commodities. They're going to move their money over there. And that's one of the reasons why Kiplinger says that the commodity bubble may deflate at least to some degree by midsummer. And they actually predict that oil will go down to about $85 a barrel. Now think about that, folks. Think about what a welcome relief that would be if oil went down $20 to $85 a barrel. And you and I are sitting here thinking, Oh, boy, I'd like to have that right now. Boy, wouldn't that be just wonderful? How sick is that? Think about how sick that is, that you and I are going to feel good about, that's like the kid coming home and telling his dad that he wrecked the car, and the dad gets all upset and he says, "Oh no, I'm just kidding, Dad. And by the way, I'm okay. Here's my report card." And of course, there's a bad grade on the report card. That's the same thing. And so I don't know what's going to happen with commodities, but Kiplinger says they're going to go down. The reason why I'm skeptical of that, I do believe that there obviously, and I agree with our experts who have said that there is a bubble, that the bubble is on commodities, being part of it is being driven by speculation. There's no question about that. But what I think is going to happen in the next 6 to 12 months or so is I think we're going to find out what the real value of these commodities are. Right now, I think we've got an inflated value of the commodities. We're going to find out what the real value of the commodities are, and which will be something less than what they are, but they're not going to go down a lot. And here's the reason why I wanted to bring this up, folks. Don't, please stop yearning for $60 a barrel oil. You can forget that. And here's why. The demand is going to continue to be great. Even if China's economy eases up, and it seems to be easing up some, maybe India will, I don't know. But the global demand for oil is not going to abate that much. It's also getting harder and harder to find oil, and more expensive to find oil. Now, there are a couple of good things out there that could happen. There are a couple of finds, a couple of oil finds that we've learned about recently in the last few months that could pump a lot of new oil into the marketplace. That eventuality could create a downward pressure on the price of oil, no question about that. But barring that kind of a thing happening, which would be wonderful, but like a Christmas present that you didn't expect, oil prices are not going to come down all that much, because even if you take $20 out for the speculators, you're still going to have significant demand, and because of the availability of oil, I think you're still looking at it. I think Kiplinger's right about this $85 a barrel thing. I think that's what we're looking at. Got more to come after these messages. We're going to talk about the financial stimulus package. We're going to talk about alternative minimum tax. We're going to talk about a lot of other stuff right after these messages. Stay with me. Welcome back. It's 17 till there. A little bit of the birds bringing us back there. The birds from the Wayback Machine. Right out of, I think that's out of Ecclesiastes, that song. How about that? A rock and roll song based on the Bible. How about that? 17 till. I'm Jim Blassingame. I'm glad you're here. My websites are smallbusinessadvocate.com. That's where you can get a show and all the things that we do here. And you can also find our newsletter there, which you can subscribe to, and check out our blog there as well. And our knowledge base, that's what I was trying to say a minute ago, our knowledge base is askjim.biz. That's another website, askjim.biz, where you get small business answers now. Okay, let's move down and talk about, I tell you what, let's move over and talk about the alternative minimum tax. One thing we've talked about in the past has been the fact that the alternative minimum tax is basically a pox on the taxpayer. And, folks, I'm going to remind you of something. I haven't mentioned this in a long time, but the alternative minimum tax was created in the late 60s, as I remember, maybe like 1969. There were about, now listen, you're not going to believe this. If you haven't heard this story before, you're not going to believe it, but I promise you what I'm telling you is the truth. There were about a dozen taxpayers who were avoiding paying enough taxes. Literally, I'm telling you, there were that few, a dozen taxpayers in all of America who weren't paying enough taxes. And the government passed something called the alternative minimum tax. And what that did was that neutralized the tax shelters that they were using. It created a parallel taxation system, parallel to the standard tax system, that had no deductions, no tax shelters. And so you had to calculate your taxes in both universes for those, for certain groups of people, certain extremely high income people. And if you didn't pay, whichever one you had to pay, you could pay more tax in, either the standard system or the alternative system. That's what you had to pay. So if your alternative tax, alternative minimum tax calculation was more than your regular tax system, tax calculation, you had to pay the higher of that, okay? Now, that continued on for decades. It went into the 80s, right? And so in the 80s, more and more average people were getting tax shelters, were buying tax shelters. But still, alternative minimum tax wasn't hitting that many people because it was pretty much designed for the really high income folks. Still a small group of people. Now, along comes the Tax Reform Act of 1986, which did abolish, for all intents and purposes, 99.785% of all tax shelters that had been, like the real estate tax shelters and the R&D tax shelters and some of the cattle tax shelters and all those things that had been flowing out there in the 70s and 80s. It literally made those things, it abolished them. It made them over. In fact, it was retroactive. The benefits you thought you were going to get in the future that you bought, it took those away from you. So, all of the mechanisms that was giving people tax advantages that gave rise to the alternative minimum tax, all of those things went away. But guess what? The government didn't do away with the alternative minimum tax. They should have. Part of the deal when the Tax Reform Act of 86 was passed, part of the deal should have been that the alternative minimum tax is also goes away because the reason for its being in existence went away. But they didn't do that. And see, this is a lesson, folks. This is a cautionary tale about establishing a tax and with the anticipation one day of doing away with it. Folks, remember this. This is a natural law. Once governments establish taxes, they never take them away. They never remove them. They may alter them, they may adjust them, but they never remove them. We now know that for sure, and the alternative minimum tax is a perfect example of that. So, guess what happened now? In the meantime, over the last 20 years, the alternative minimum tax was never adjusted for inflation. So, today, millions, not 12, but millions of Americans are being hit with the alternative minimum tax because it was not adjusted for inflation. And so now more and more average Americans are up into the range that the alternative minimum tax is catching them. And it's a pox on the American taxpayer, and it should be done away with. It should be abolished today. Retroactive to last year. But they won't do it. And you know why? Because it's bringing in cash. It's bringing in tax revenues. So the government's not going to... Our politicians are not going to get rid of that. That's like asking a meth addict to give up his methamphetamines. He's not going to do that. It's like asking a crack addict, a crackhead, to give you his crack without a fight. Our tax dollars are their drug, ladies and gentlemen, and they're not going to give it back until we make them give it back, which I want you to think about this. What I just told you, folks, is the truth. It's happening right now, and now what they've got is what they call a short-term patch for the alternative minimum tax. You know what? We don't need to patch it. We need to get rid of it, and that ought to be a big, maybe it will be a big campaign issue this year. And so listen for that when you talk to your politicians. Quick break. 10 till. I'm Jim Blassingame. Stay with me. I'll be right back. She's got it.
And the land is dark, and the moon is the only light we'll see.
Welcome back. It's 7-till. I'm Jim Blasingame. Thank you very much for joining me. Thanks for hanging out with me. It's my pleasure, as always. One of the things that Kiplinger reports today, and by the way, a lot of the things I've been talking about this hour have been based on some of the things that Kiplinger says is going on in the letter. And of course, you know, you can tell the difference between what Kiplinger says and my editorializing. I know you've been listening to me long enough to know that. I'm reporting the issues that Kiplinger points out, and letting them provide us with the facts, and then I'm providing the editorialization. And I'm never more of an editorialist than when I'm talking about unions. You know my attitude about unions. I'm not a union fan. I'm not a supporter of unions. I think unions' day has come and gone. I think that the worst thing that's happened to some of the things that needs to happen in the 21st century is we need to get rid of the teachers' unions. They have too much power. The government employee unions, the municipality unions, those are not good for this country, in my opinion. The trade unions have become a cesspool. The leadership, not the workers, not the individuals, but the leadership's become basically a cesspool. They're not anything that, and this is me, folks. This is nobody else's opinion but mine. And I'm a very, very much a negative detractor. I'm a serious detractor of unions. I'm very disappointed in the role that they're playing in the 21st century. And nowhere are they having more of an impact than they are in politics. But here is a Kiplinger quote. Labor plans to spend over $100 million in the coming months to elect pro-worker candidates to the White House, to Congress, to state and local offices. That's AFL-CIO, and then there's one called Change to Win, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Look, folks, union impact on politics is growing. Union membership is not growing. It's been dropping like a stone for 30 years. Why is that? They don't have a product they can sell. Their product is not a good product. They're trying to sell protection at a time when more and more companies are taking better care of their employees. Look, my parents were both union back in the 40s and 50s and 60s, et cetera, et cetera. There was a time when unions served a purpose. They played a part that was important. Those days are gone. They're not valid anymore. And I just think that the role that union leadership, not the individuals, union leadership is playing in the marketplace and in politics today is very detrimental. And let me give you an example. They've got something they call the Employee Free Choice Act that they're trying to get passed. They're trying to get this passed into a law, Employee Free Choice Act. And we've talked about this on the show before. That is a misnomer. Employee Free Choice Act is a lie, basically. All right, here's what it means. Well, let me back up. Historically, if you voted for some union activity, you voted for it with a private ballot, secret ballot, just as we do, as we all do. It's the basis of democracy, right? It's one of the foundational elements of democracy is the secret ballot, so that we can all vote however we want to, and nobody knows how we voted. It's nobody's business, right? Well, the Employee Free Choice Act, if you thought about that, you say, oh, I like it. I like free. I like choice. I like employees. Yes, that's good. I love that. Guess what? That's not what it means. What it means is that somebody can walk up to you, a union leader can walk up to you and stick a sheet of paper in front of you with a ballot on it and ask you and tell you to vote right now in front of him or her. And if they pass the Employee Free Choice Act, that means that the secret ballots will go away. And people will know how you vote. It's such a horrible product these days. Government fiat, and that's what they're trying to get done with this Free Choice Act. So I want to encourage you, small business owners, to vote for candidates who are not going to vote for the Employee Free Choice Act, that won't promote the Employee Free Choice Act, because it's not good for the marketplace, it's not good for the economy, it's not good for the worker, and it sure as heck isn't good for small business. Those are my thoughts. That's my idea on how things are going. I got to go for this hour. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate, and as you know, this program is for you. And remember this one last thing. A ship in the harbor is safe, but that's not what ships were made for.
Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blassingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., intended for the private use of our audience. Except as otherwise provided by copyright law, all other copying, redistribution, or publication without prior written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.